Welcome to the Bruce Poinsett Show. This is the world's most dangerous infomercial. Along with my producer, Ado, we bring you this bi-weekly news, commentary, and interview experience from the Numbers FM studio at the Portland Art Museum. You can catch the full show on Wednesdays at 7 p.m. on the Numbers FM 96.7. And you can catch clips on youtube.com/Bruce Poinsett, as well as exclusive bonus content by becoming a member at patreon.com/Bruce Poinsett. Let me repeat that. Become a member at patreon.com/Bruce Poinsett for exclusive content. But right now we're live on Twitch, and you can follow the Numbers on Twitch at twitch.tv/the numbers. And that's Numbers with a Z. So twitch.tv/the numbers FM. Again, that's twitch.tv/the numbers FM. But we like to begin each show with the news stories you might've missed, but should be on your radar. So now, without further ado, the news. First story comes from the Portland Mercury by Isabella Garcia. It's titled, Wheeler Moves Forward with Controversial Gunshot Detection Technology. According to Garcia, Mayor Ted Wheeler's office will develop a pilot program for the controversial gunshot detection technology ShotSpotter, according to an announcement at a police oversight meeting Thursday evening. The pilot will need to be voted on by city council before being adopted by the city. ShotSpotter uses microphones placed on telephone poles, streetlights, and other tall structures in the city to detect gunshot and gunshot-like sounds. When a microphone picks up the sound, ShotSpotter sends a local law enforcement the general location of the sound. The intention of the technology, according to the company, is to provide an alternative to police departments relying exclusively on 911 calls to be alerted to a shooting. The program is currently used in over 100 cities with varying degrees of success. According to ShotSpotter, the technology has a 0.5% false positivity rate when reporting gunshots to local law enforcement. The report determined that considering Portland's shooting trends, ShotSpotter could deliver 66 false positive reports each year. Smart City PDX believe the number of false positives could be too high of a risk for the city. Because law enforcement officers are sent to the area anticipating lethal weapons to be present, possibly creating a dangerous situation for members of the public who could be mistaken for a shooter during a false alarm. A 2021 study by Chicago's Office of the Inspector General found that 9% of ShotSpotter alerts sent police to a scene of a gun-related criminal offense. Klepper noted that linking a ShotSpotter alert to evidence of a shooting can be challenging, which could explain the low percentage. The Inspector General also found that Chicago officers used the microphone's alert as a reason to stop and question residents, regardless of whether the alert was tied to an actual gunshot, leading Smart City PDX to raise concerns that ShotSpotter reports could be used to justify stop and frisk action on residents. So, again, more concerning news from the mayor's office. Again, luckily, there's still a vote that the city council needs to take before this pilot program is implemented. But as noted in this and past coverage we've reported on ShotSpotter, the idea of 66 false positive reports, which could be, 66 officer related shootings that could happen, seems like a risk too much for me. The idea that they can also use this as a pretext for, again, harassing people, shaking people down, the same way, marijuana laws and drug war laws are used, and that we're putting it up to technology, which again, in a industry that is run still largely by white people and white supremacy, reflects the same white supremacist results. It's scary, and shout out to the activists who've been, covering this, protesting against this in the city. There's still time to make sure ShotSpotter doesn't get implemented in Portland, but it's ticking away fast. Our next story comes from OPB. It's titled, Newburgh School's Ban on Certain Symbols Violates Oregon's Constitution, YAML Circuit Court Rules. And it's by Elizabeth Miller. Miller writes, the case filed by the ACLU of Oregon on behalf of Newburgh School employee Chelsea Schatz in December 21 challenges a policy approved by the school board last year. The policy bans employees from displaying controversial political signs or symbols. The initial board conversations about the policy centered around banning Black Lives Matter and LGBTQ plus pride flags. On Thursday, Yamhill County Circuit Court Judge Cynthia Easterday ruled that the policy is unconstitutional under Article 1, Section 8 of the Oregon Constitution, which guarantees the freedom of speech and the press. Since the school board approved the policy in September 2021, tension and conflict has continued among school board members, district employees, and those in the Newburgh community. Four members of the school board voted to fire Superintendent Joe Moorlach last November. Two board members faced recall elections in January, and since last year, dozens of staff members have resigned from the district, including several administrators and principals from six of the district's 10 schools. The three board members who did not vote for the policy banning controversial political symbols resigned over the course of the last year, alleging harassment. The remaining board members have been involved in multiple lawsuits. So, Newburgh School District is a mess, as many could ascertain if you've been following these news stories. But this is a small positive in terms of constitutional law ruling that, yes, teachers can still display symbols to show support for students, especially underrepresented students in, once again, a hostile school district, in a hostile environment. So, you know, it's looking very bleak in Newburgh, but there is one win. Next story comes from the Oregonian. It's titled, Portland Elections Program Fines Rene Gonzalez $77,000 Over Cushy Campaign Office Deal. It's by Shane Kavanaugh. Kavanaugh writes, since May, Gonzalez's campaign has paid a mere $250 a month to rent more than 3,000 square feet in a Southwest 11th Avenue office building owned by Jordan Snitzer, a real estate mogul and philanthropist who also donated the most money allowed by law, $250, to the candidate, according to city elections officials and campaign finance reports. But the fair market value of the high-ceiling first-floor office, which comes with a pair of parking spaces, is about $6,900 a month, Susan Modette, the director of Portland's small donor elections program, wrote in a letter to Gonzalez on Tuesday. That amounts to an unreported discount of 96%, one that Motet claimed is an illegal in-kind contribution under the city's public campaign finance program, which has thus far provided $370,000 in matching funds to Gonzalez, a lawyer and businessman, throughout his race for the city council. City elections officials have ordered Gonzalez pay $33,250 for accepting the discount office space and another $10,640 for failing to report it, according to the letter. He's also required to reimburse Schnitzer Properties Management the unpaid $33,250. So, funny activity happening in a very contested Portland City Council race. You have, I think, well, obviously, we can talk about Rene Gonzalez and receiving a questionable donation. I think this is a very opportune time to talk about the role donors play in politics, which is a gigantic, outsized, and very inequitable one. So right here, you have Jordan Snitzer, which I think he's Snitzer. Yes, that's Snitzer. It's a lot of money, a lot of power in the city of Portland. And even when you have finance rules that allow a maximum of $250 to donate, there are other ways, such as in-kind donations. And in this case, it was flag, but, you know, there are other ways to provide support for candidates, to provide things that make it easier to run an election, easier to deal with all the things that come with running an election while also, again, also working, also, you know, going through your regular life. So we'll keep an eye on how this goes and keep an eye on an election. Again, very important. Midterms are coming up. Don't get caught sleeping. Our last story comes from OPB. It's titled, Oregon Tech Offers In-State Tuition to All Native American Students. It's by Mira Powell. Powell writes, OIT announced that all enrolled members of federally recognized Native American tribes will qualify for in-state tuition at the university starting this week, regardless of where they live. Oregon Tech's announcement follows four other schools in the state that have also made this decision: Portland State University, Oregon State University, Southern Oregon University, and Western Oregon University. Out-of-state Native American students who qualify for the in-state tuition rate could save up to $10,000 per term, depending on the number of credits they're taking and their major, according to OIT. These individual announcements are separate from the state's new Oregon Tribal Student Grant Program. The statewide program covers tuition and living costs for Oregonians who are members of one of the state's 9 federally recognized tribes. So education, access to higher education, all the resources and networking that comes on college campuses is a huge factor in just your ability to get employment, get jobs with benefits, work for yourself, be able to honestly succeed in the world out here. So this is a major development and I think very important thing that we'd like to see continue trending, and hopefully Oregon can serve as an example for other states to continue providing access to more affordable higher education. And, you know, hopefully this can be a step towards free higher education in the U.S. We do want to see, you know, again, it's a matter of jobs. It's a matter of the welfare and well-being of our communities. And we're all better. We have more access to educational opportunities, whether that's university, whether that's trade schools, et cetera. So we love to see it. We hope to see more. And that's the news.
The Bruce Poinsett Show will be back after this quick commercial break. The Bruce Poinsett Show is made possible by the support of members at patreon.com/Bruce Poinsett. Patreon is a service that allows you to directly support creators like myself through monthly or annual memberships. Become a member for as little as $3 a month and get access to exclusive bonus clips and live discussions. Check out this clip from the page.
Are you defending the prequels? Where does your defense end, Bruce?
So, you know what? Maybe this might surprise you, but yeah, the whole meal deal. I will defend the prequels, kind of. Again, I also had a disclaimer at the beginning that I would not put money on me if I were betting on this as a viewer. But will I defend the prequels? Yes.
If you enjoy this content and believe in the community I'm trying to build, please support by becoming a member at patreon.com/Bruce Poinsett.
Welcome back to the Bruce Poinsett Show. This is the B block where I get a little artsy today. Ado, you've been watching Atlanta at all?
I'm a little bit behind, but I've heard that the new season is fantastic. I might end up binging it, but I know that it's Atlanta, so it's usually rocking. What have I missed though?
Man, so try not to spoil too much. But this last episode, I'm just call it the YWA episode, the Young White Avatar episode, where short story is Paperboy is in this meeting with other hip hop veterans, and it's this basically like laying out how to succeed in the music industry today, and it's like find a YWA, Young White Avatar. Yep. So, you can probably think of the parallels in the actual music industry.
Yep.
But, I love that. And it also kind of, I feel like it was emblematic of something that I've been noticing more recently, which is that it's like the cultural appropriation conversation is getting interesting again.
Definitely. Uh-huh.
It sounds weird to say, but it's just like, you go on social media and it's just very, you get these like very hack and remedial takes on cultural appropriation or, especially, white people trying to be like, well, what about this? Well, what about the Wu-Tang Clan? But, and then people arguing with them. And it's just like, we know, but nothing interesting is happening here.
Mm.
But more recently, you have like Atlanta with this episode talking about YWAs and you had a Issa Rae Show rap. Sorry, Ada.
That's all good. That's all good. It's the name of the show. We're chilling.
Exactly. So they did they did this skit with one like this white rapper character doing Not Atlanta, which it's funny because obviously like Not Atlanta was this big viral hit from like an actual artist, and they originally released it as like
it was like a YouTube video or something, and the internet went crazy because they thought like this was an actual white girl just hijacking Not Atlanta.
Yes.
You saw that, right?
Yes, I did, and I loved it. I thought it was a pretty genius play to kind of play off the whole white people in hip hop just jacking right now. Mm-hmm. So like that was a good moment to me.
Yeah, I thought, you know, just when we talk about like rollouts and, you know, marketing campaigns, kind of genius just to, you know, one, just kind of like use people's, their reactions, like flip their reactions on themselves, get people hyped up. I thought it was pretty clever.
Right.
But then I think the biggest one was Effin' Mecca, the AI rapper.
Yeah.
Like, for those who aren't familiar, I forgot what the company's name is, but, you know, some tech bro company in Silicon Valley, they created this, like, ethnically ambiguous, you know, rapper stereotype AI character. They got, like, a actual artist to, like, do like, the lyrics.
Yep,
a black artist. But then they didn't pay him.
Yep.
Right? So, you know.
That was a great start to their little mission there.
Oh, yeah. But, no, this character, like, I guess he had, like, one song, ironically, with Gunna, that was, like, a hit. But we'll get back to that in a second.
Yeah.
But, the thing that was, I guess, most notable about this character is just the social media antics. Like, he'd be, you know, he has a hibachi in the back of his car.
Mm-hmm.
It's foreign. He's got, you know, he's doing all types, just shooting all types of guns in different, like, random videos.
Did you see the police brutality video?
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah, that was the best. He did a post on a social media post where he's getting beat up by a cop in jail. It's like, police brutality. They're trying to get me to snitch, but I won't. It's the worst.
It was the absolute worst.
The absolute worst. But again, had like a hit song completely, you know, the AI rapper hit song with Gunna, who, fun story, is actually in jail right now on RICO charges for, yes, you know, everything Effin' Mecca was basically making fun of.
And it's crazy too. That's a case as well, where it's like, I believe when I last checked in, they actually did not have any, I think they just recently dropped Gunna's like assault charges, saying that like he didn't do any of the assault charges that he's attached to. So it's like a lot of the charges with Gunna specifically, because like he got arrested because like of his attachment to the group and like lyrics and stuff like that. So it's just kind of like, dang, like Effin' Mecca over here making fun of police brutality as the person that he just recently worked with is being treated terribly by the police system. It's very ironic.
And the thing that's even wilder about Effin' Mecca is that for a brief moment, this AI character got signed to Capitol Records.
Yep.
And, you know, people, when that news came out, again, the internet kind of blew up. And because this was happening for a while, but it was when the character got signed that people were just like, no more. And, you know, thankfully, Capitol Records pulled the deal.
They dropped. Thank God they dropped him.
You know, but still, it kind of brings up this question that we've been talking about, you know, just as like a culture for a while, where it's like they love black art, but they don't love black people.
Bingo.
And you see these, you know, obviously, like the conversation alluded to with white rappers, it's like, all right, we're going to have white rappers, you know, push out black artists. And is that going to happen? And I mean, we've seen this kind of like happen with a lot of, you know, any genre of American music, really, to varying degrees. You know, like you look at like jazz or something. You know, Kenny G was really popular for a while, but also, you know, I would venture to say that, you know, the days of like Miles Davis and John Coltrane are, well, they're back in those days.
Yep.
For a lot of people, I don't want to discredit. There's a lot of really dope jazz artists out there, and there's really a lot of dope jazz music out there. But in terms of like its hold on the popular scene, it's a different time.
It's a very different time. And like, yeah, the jazz world is not what it looked like quite some time ago.
Then you could also look at like rock music, and, you know, obviously rock got taken by the whites, and rockers are doing well.
Rock really got gentrified, like fully,
you know, so it's a mixed bag. Uh-huh. But that brings us back to hip hop, where, you know, if you're not like with this AI rapper thing, they're going to keep doing it. This is a test run. Like, it failed, but they're going to come out with another one. Clearly they showed like there's a hit song already. Mm-hmm. So keep your eye out on that. But let's go back to white rappers for a minute. Let's go to cultural appropriation, because when I was watching, you know, the Atlanta episode, I think it was impossible not to think Jack Harlow.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know. Do you listen to Jack Harlow?
I have an interesting history with Jack Harlow. I found him way before any like huge fame moment in high school. And I remember he was like never in my rotation deeply, but I remember like being like, oh, like this little white boy from Kentucky, he's doing his thing. He isn't like rapping about guns or gang violence or anything. Like, he's just kind of being him, doing him, back then when he was like nerdy and had the glasses too. So it was like very much so like, this is a white boy doing white boy things. And then he got really famous, started hanging out with Drake, and it started looking a type of way. And now, as we see, Jack Harlow is attempting to be a light-skinned black man, and it's not my favorite look right now.
I mean, I can't say it just feels like from the outside looking in, I say this knowing, you know, maybe this is just like an old man take. I definitely have old man ears when it comes to music, but it just feels like people are really trying to make Jack Harlow happen. And I didn't like know his history like that. So I was watching an interview on Hot 97 with DJ Drama, where, you know, actually, to bring it back to the Atlanta episode, because again, not spoilers for the people, sorry, but
spoiler, you know, moment.
They're at the Grammys and someone's asked about, you know, this YWA that popped off, and it's like, Yodel Kid, that was you? And that was exactly the moment where because it made me think of that Drama interview, because I didn't realize he was, you know, involved, and he was a big part in the Jack Harlow thing.
Yep.
And I was like, oh. And, you know, it's not like, again, it's not like a new thing. Uh-huh. Obviously, it's kind of, you know, been the case, but I like what you said about, like, when you found Jack Harlow, he was just kind of like a white boy doing, you know, his white thing. He wasn't trying to be someone else. Because, you know, we've seen, you know, I think this kind of like highlights where we are now versus like past times, where when we talk about like appropriation, it's very obvious, or it's very like intentional and gross.
Right.
Versus like a thing where, no, people, we're in a space where people can be themselves.
Mm-hmm.
But there still becomes a conversation of, yeah, even when people are being themselves, are we pushing out black artists?
Truly.
Because, you know, we're in a market where most of the consumers are white people in America, mm-hmm. or globally, you know, yeah, consumers, not just white people, but, you know, especially like a lot of Asian markets, you know, like European markets, and anti-blackness is worldwide.
Going crazy.
Right. So, you know, it's not, you know, as opposed to the days of like Iggy Azalea, or you remember Slim Jesus?
Oh my God, do I remember Slim Jesus? Yes.
When, you know, when Chief Keef first popped off, and then they had some white kid who looked like, you know, an 11-year-old cosplaying as Eminem and be fake. Oh, good times. Good times.
A classic moment.
No, we're in different times.
Like, we're in very different times.
I think about this being in Portland specifically because a joke I've constantly made is just like, you know, if you give me like a, I don't know, a dream cipher draft or something where I get four MCs and a producer or something like that, right? Mm-hmm. And it's like, if we're just doing like white rappers and we're having white rappers battle it out across the country, I feel good with taking my Portland team many places. Like, I mean that seriously. Like, you know, shout out. We got people here. Like, shout out to Milk, you know, Slick Devious, Win, Only One. You know, we got some white rappers who can really, really do it out here.
We've had quite a few white rappers pop out of here.
And, you know, they're themselves, which is cool. But then you think about, like you said, like what happened with Jack Harlow when he blew up? Like, what is that not to say that, you know, if anyone from here blew up, would it not?
The same thing happened.
Yeah, would we not see the same trajectory? So, again, we're in this interesting thing with, like, the cultural appropriation conversation where it's not even like, oh, we're trying to, like, jack styles anyone.
Yeah. I mean,
there's still that. Like, let's be clear. That's still very much happening. But it's beyond that. It's where it's like, okay, the game is opened up. People can be themselves. Mm-hmm. And is that something that, you know, the wider audience, the specifically, you know, not black audience is going to say, okay, well, now we have the option of these people, or now that we have the option of more rappers, more rap personalities that look like us, we're just going to keep choosing them and then just kind of wean that out. But even then, again, we look at that, like Macklemore example, we look at, you know, people we've named, we look at, I guess the jury's still out on Jack Harlow, but it's like,
I mean,
these efforts to make it happen
keep on failing. I think the hopeful piece of all this, because I think, like, truly the issue is no longer in the hands of the artist. It's like, honestly, I'm going to commend someone who can play the game well enough to, like, especially in hip hop, like, if you can finesse your way in, wow, like, you did it. You did something that a bunch of people want to try and do, and you somehow figured it out.
Right.
So it's like, cool, like, you made it that far. It is now in the hands of the consumers to decide your place. And I find it really funny because, for example, and this is what gives me hope in the hip hop area, at least, is like, so you have someone like a Jack Harlow who, from like when he first blew up, it was like the black community was really messing with him. Like, there was, I remember going through Twitter, reading comments and having like so many like black tweets being like, oh, like Jack Harlow's like the one who can do it. Like, we mess with Jack Harlow. The second his last album dropped, silence. Silence. And like, hate to say it, but when the Grammy situation happened for Macklemore, like, again, this is no beef on Macklemore. Once that situation went down, it was done for Macklemore. Like, once he took up too much space, it was over.
It's just not, yeah, even, you know, you're talking about like LP, Mac Miller, Eminem, especially, like, talking about people who were, you know, exceptional artists.
Yep.
Yeah, with Jack Harlow, it's just like, people keep trying to make this happen, and it's just like, I'm just bored. Right. I'm so bored.
I'm bored. It's not, in fact, I'm not even like entertained in like a bad way. Like, there's a bunch of white rappers on the internet. Like, that small sect of white people who like Eminem have like a list of white rappers that are some of the most hilarious people in the game. And it's like, at least they can entertain me. Like, with Jack, I'm just bored right now. Like, you're not even entertaining anymore. You're just out here like being boring.
They're forcing it, like, art. Sometimes, you know, not everyone can, you know, aspire to excellence and all that, but I don't know, just to bring it back to the cultural appropriation part, is like, it's when you see so much infrastructure, so much industry infrastructure trying to make this happen,
right,
while other artists exist, while other things are happening. You're just like, ugh. Like, this is, I mean, I don't know, maybe, again, I have this, like, Northwest chip on my shoulder type thing where it's like, I could give this time to Aminé, you could give this time to Gift to Gab, you know,
Give it to the plethora. Like, there's so many. The amount of, like, there's an artist from Seattle. His name is Highway. And to me, like, he's doing the whole, like, he's really pushing the sound for the Pacific Northwest. And I think doing something different from what a lot of Pacific Northwest artists are doing. And it's like, he's still in the underground. And I'm like, yo, like, can we, instead of giving all of this space to this white person, because again, like, that's really the issue. When you give too much space to a white artist, it's like, at a certain point, like, people don't want to hear them. Like, no one like in my black circle is like clamoring for Jack Harlow right now. No one cares. So I'm like, how about you give that space to someone else? Move him aside and, like, you know, like, give love to, I'm really excited about this artist Glorilla right now. Like, no one's like, not to say no one's giving her love, but it's like, she has pop star material. We don't need Jack Harlow on my screen. Give me Glorilla. Give me a Saweetie. Give me someone else who, like, deserves the space more.
Yeah, man. I feel that's the perfect place to end it. Instead, you know, it's like either gotta be the YWA or, God, what was that? There was a kid they were pushing for a minute. Lil Xan, that was the one. Or it's just like,
stop it.
You gotta stop. You can give this space to anything else.
Anyone else.
It was just funny. Like, I remember those, like, Hot 97 interviews with, like, Rosenberg and Ebro, Laura Styles, all being like visibly, you know, visibly irritated that they have to, like, irritate or interview this kid.
Yep.
And do this conversation, listen to some random white kid whose only personality trait is
Xanax.
I do Xannies. Talk about why he doesn't respect Tupac. And it's like,
and it's just like, yo.
Again, we'll see how the industry moves. I kind of, you know, at my space, I own that I have, like, old man ears. So my views on the industry or whatever they are, I might be stuck in 2006 forever. But
don't blame you.
It is hard not to see the economic impacts of this. And I think, you know, that episode of Atlanta made it, you know, interesting, because when you talk about whether it's the characters in there, like the dramas and, you know, the people in real life who, you know, are behind this. So it's not like it's a just white. We get to be in the business now, but still, how does it play out? We'll see, I suppose.
We'll just have to see.
The Bruce Poinsett Show will be back after this quick ad break. BrucePoinsett.com is your one-stop shop for everything Bruce Poinsett. You have my services such as freelance writing and editing, creative nonfiction courses, as well as customized writing classes, event facilitation, and digital content creation. Again, go to BrucePoinsett.com for a quote and make sure to sign up for our newsletter so you don't miss any news or updates.
Welcome back to the Bruce Poinsett Show. We have a special guest in the building today, Mr. Max Smith.
Hello, hello.
How are you doing today?
You know, it's been a pretty good Wednesday. Is it Thursday? It's Thursday. I don't know.
Definitely Thursday, but yeah, it's all good.
It's been a good Thursday then.
You know, and we're coming in on special times. You're in the, as you know, we shoot in the Portland Art Museum.
Yes.
And as far as Twitter is concerned, you may or may not be at war with the Portland Art Museum.
At war? That's so strong.
No. But you recently wrote an article, Flashes of the 2020 Protest for the Portland Mercury. Mm-hmm. Subhead, of course, Portland Art Museum's perspective celebrates photographers of color who captured the 2020 George Floyd protests, but images of police violence are strangely absent. And if people have been on Twitter and follow you, you've gotten some strong reactions to this.
To be fair, and I think this happens a lot with social media and with, you know, just modern press. Mm-hmm. If you read the article, it does not actually say what the header of the article, which I did not write, says. Mm-hmm. So I can see some people saying, oh my gosh, he wants more pictures of, like, you know, police brutality. And if you start with that and don't read the article, then I can understand people being upset. But if you read the article, it's pretty clear that I'm looking for context, not for police pictures. Yeah.
Right. Let me just pull up She had one quote that I think was, we talk about the, the function of the museum. So it's like, this exhibit, which fills a room previously occupied with art representing Frida Kahlo and Diego Rivera, places the energy of the protest firmly in the past. This is the natural function of a museum, to recognize the past. And I have not been able to shake the feeling that to many, the resistance is over. You know, I think it, just to, again, kind of put this in perspective, again, we're in the Portland Art Museum. Where this exhibit is. And like I said, I've read the article. Most of it is very, I recognize the brilliance of individual photographers. And, you do point out, someone who was out there in the streets covering the protest, and also, very much crediting the photographers who were also out there. That, it is noticeable. You can't help but feel some kind of way. Specifically, you pointed to one photo. I think it was of an officer or police chief, Chuck Lavelle.
It was, yes.
That kind of, how you say it, like woke you up.
I mean, the way I felt about it was, I kind of got a chance to go in the first day and kind of get the preview, like the early, viewing. And I walk around, I'm looking at all the pictures, and I kind of, and that part of the exhibit, Byron Merritt's section, is kind of in its own little area. And when I was looking at the pictures, he basically captured pictures from in front of the Apple store where the large George Floyd mural had gone up. So his area, his section with his pictures is basically a collection of portraits that he took in that space. And in context, that makes a lot of sense. But one of the portraits is of the police chief and a secondary, and like another officer. And they're in front of the George Floyd poster, like with like a smirk. And since he's taking portraits in front of this space, he would be taking portraits of anyone that comes in that space, right? So it could be a clown, it could be a cop, it could be a person, it could be a, a student, it could be kids, it's whatever. So that makes sense in that individualized context. But I felt like in the larger context of the exhibit, that picture felt strange, a picture of a police officer and a police chief smiling in front of a picture of George Floyd, who was murdered by police, which started this entire protest, and they're sitting there with a picture of the police chief smiling. Like, it's just, it doesn't make any sense to me. You know what I mean? So once I saw that, I kind of got out of the mode of, oh, these are all my friends' pictures. These are cool pictures of people that I know or have just met, or I follow their work. And it became a, what else have I been missing? Then I started looking more at the exhibit, and I kind of, because I was in the, hey, this is really nice, little flashback to the past, and man, makes me want to walk again, just like, Linnea said. But at the same time, once that hit, it was kind of like, well, what's missing here? Because I couldn't shake the feeling already that something was kind of missing, but I was happy, you know what I mean? It's like when you're kind of distracted. And then once I had a thread to pull, I started pulling that thread. Why would this police officer picture be in here? How does it make sense with the rest? Does not make sense with the rest. And then I had to kind of wrestle with those things and think of what is the intent of this exhibit. And I started to realize, oh, what's missing is not images of police violence, but what's missing is the context of what brought people out in the streets. This is showing people a flash of a moment. Lots of people standing on bridges, raising their hands, standing on cars, dancing, standing in front of cops, pointing at them. The cops are pointing back. People walking through tear gas bits, right? But it's not really showing why we're there. There's an entire area that shows George Floyd in the background of every single picture. But there's nothing that says, there's nothing that really indicates why people were angry. It just shows that people were there and that there were these feelings and emotions. And I started to think, like, how does that impact, what is a museum allowed to do? You know, I'm not asking for pictures of police hurting anyone, but how much context can they put? Could they put a thing saying, instead of saying, these artists were doing this, could they say in response to massive police violence? There's nothing that says that out there. Across the country. And it's not just about George Floyd. We had people getting shot by cops here too in that same time frame. Black people getting shot by cops in that same time frame. Mentally handicapped people getting, we're under investigation or under, what do you call it, with the feds, under a lawsuit or whatever it is, right? So when you have all that context just missing, it makes it look like people were just out there passionate and we're proud of them for trying, to do whatever it is they were doing and go home now. I also thought it was strange that the pictures are not in frames. They're tacked to the wall, which makes it feel very temporary, right? I don't think it could have been an artistic choice. That's fine. But each choice results in a reaction, right? Mm-hmm. And my reaction is these pictures are on the wall tacked, the same way I put stuff on my fridge or I'm on the bulletin board in my job. But the pictures that I love, I put in frames. They have frames. They're not shorter frames in the museum. So that's a conscious decision. And why was it made that way? Is it a lack of a forethought? Is it just a quick thing because we need to get this done today? Was it a conscious decision? And what was the meaning behind that? I don't know. I didn't get an answer for it when I asked around. So that to me was a thing that I commented in the article, you know, that I felt that the framing of the entire exhibit in general, including the frames individual, was hiding something. It was holding something back. And someone asked, how come you have to do that? How come you have to think? I said, well, and someone commented that, you know, when you choose to exclude certain bits of information from an exhibit about an event, that's a political statement. And I don't think it's necessarily a bad thing, but I think it's something that should be discussed and thought about.
Yeah, I mean, I think just to kind of bring this out to like a macro level.
Yeah, of course.
I think this is kind of like elicit an interesting conversation about how we engage with art.
Yeah.
You know, and like Ado and I, before you got here, we're kind of just talking about, I don't know, just like a frustration or kind of like being over this idea of just like doing safe stuff in Portland. You know, like for better or worse, I think, this person, I think art should make you feel something.
Yeah.
It should elicit an emotion. And sometimes you're not going to be happy with it. You're not going to be, you know.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, you have this exhibit and you have someone engaging with it critically.
Yeah.
Praising many parts of it, but also asking these questions.
Yeah.
And is that not how this is supposed to work? And is that not how, you know, you have the art, you have the critique of the art, and you have a lot of people in the city reacting to the art and the critique of the art and actually like engaging with it with actual emotions. Mm. Like, is that, again,
the point of the art?
Yeah.
It's not the point of art.
But also,
is that not the point? Like, is the point not to have something that is aesthetically interesting to you, but also causes you to think more?
Mm-hmm.
That's why there's, I mean, like, That's why so many people can't get on tune with like a lot of like of like, you know, like radio music or whatever, because it's mindless, right? It's fine. It sounds good. It has the aesthetic quality that you like, the aesthetic pleasantries, mm-hmm. but it lacks anything, yeah. right? There's no, it doesn't give you any new thoughts unless you're like a child, right? It doesn't mm-hmm. do anything for you emotionally, you know, and mentally. Whereas you find your album cuts, your things that you listen to, your more niche music, it fits into what you're doing and explores things that you're into, right? So that causes you to think in better ways. You know, you can watch, you know, Spider-Man and Friends and learn about manners. And if you're six, that's great. But when you're an adult, you need a movie that, a show that's going to give you something with real questions, real, not what do I do if I'm out of peanut butter? Go to the store. Like you need more than that when you get older. Mm-hmm. And art can do that for you. Not to say that art has to be educational or even like provide any answers, but it should get you thinking, in my opinion. It mm-hmm. should get you thinking about something. And to me, like this perspectives exhibit, it did that. Mm-hmm. So to me, like I had some people say, well, I don't understand why you're like, you know, digging on. I'm like, I'm not digging on it. It got me thinking. Me saying, and then this part made me uncomfortable is the compliment. Because if I start the article off saying, I didn't really feel any emotion watching these pictures. I was like, yeah, I was there. I feel it. People were like, oh my God, it's coming back to me. And I'm like, yeah, it didn't really leave for me. Mm-hmm. So I get that. But then like when I saw that picture, I was like, that woke me up. So thank you for that picture because it woke me up and it made me think about things. I wouldn't have included it because it's not what I would have done. But I'm not the same artist as him, right? So I feel like that's kind of like the beauty of the exhibit.
I mean, I'm just going to, again, it's just my opinion, but mm-hmm. if I were to hypothesize what the actual issue is probably that, you know, you have white people retweeting it and
could be.
People don't like, you know, black writer talking about black photographers, and kind of, because I'll admit, like, I think I reposted your article, and I have like one white person write it to me. It's like, oh, you know, we're thinking about going, but we don't know if it like whitewashes the history and all that. And it was like, yeah, I could get why, you know, especially I think about this from my own perspective. Mm-hmm. It's like, I just hosted this thing last night and I had, you know, a person come up to me and was not really feeling it. And so, you know, having that, you know, that one like emotion, just like, oh, I finally did this thing, got that off, and you have this relief, and then have someone kind of like press you. I get that feeling of like, but at the same time, also, you know, it's, again, like after a while, you get tired of doing safe stuff. I know I've done plenty of stuff that's just like, you know, people will reshare it because they feel like they need to, but that dies down
real quick
over time. You know, getting the nice, like the claps and like, yeah,
good job. You wrote words, black man. Yeah.
Yeah. Like,
we don't need that.
I want, even if it like makes people mad. So I was like, I'd rather have that. I want people to feel like I'm not just going out there to shock people. I'm saying real things. Yeah. Right. And I was telling you off camera, it's like, what's kind of cool about this is like, you kind of like, you got the Charlemagne effect, but like organically and with visual art of all things.
Yeah. You know, it's weird to me. It's not really weird to me. It's normal. People just want to have something to debate, and they want to also put their own spin on things, which is natural. That's what I did, right? Mm-hmm. So people are going to see this piece and find things that they also are going to think about. To me, it's weird when people do that when they haven't seen the event. They haven't seen the exhibit, so they don't really have anything to feed back. They're just saying stuff based on internet vernacular, right? They're just saying stuff, rhetoric. I heard this, I'm going to say it too. You know what? Yeah, F the museum. Like, that's not what I said at all, bro. That's not what I said. I didn't go after the museum. But as far as like black people, like I didn't go after any of the photographers. That was my thing for me. Like I didn't, like I thought the exhibit was great, and I think that everyone did a wonderful job. But what I did want to do, and what I almost thought wouldn't be allowed for me to do, but you know, shout out to like to the Mercury for being real ones, is like I wanted to put the question back on the curators. And the museum, not the patrons, but the museum facilitators and program directors, and not in a way that's harsh or insulting, but to say, hey, as we're looking at this, can you understand how we're missing context? And say in a way that they can understand, not a way that says, hey, I'm mad and because I'm black, man, you got to listen to me, but to say, you know, hey, legitimately here, this picture is out of, it destroys the context of what you were doing. And when that happens, people are going to ask questions about your intent. And now I have questions about your intent. What was your intent? And to create the conversation. Mm-hmm. So if the article did that, and the article is getting people to question, hey, what's the intent? And that's part of why I didn't say anything after the article posted the first day. I just retweeted it and left it alone. Put some stuff on Instagram, whatever, with the pictures and let it go. But I didn't want to really comment any further. I'd already written 1,500 words that was edited down, and I knew, and the editors I think were actually very good, but I wanted to see how the article stood on its own and how people can read it, and they're going to misinterpret and hear things wrong, but I just want to let it go and let the conversation go. And naturally, the conversation among black people, I felt, including one of the people who's actually pictured in the exhibit, was that it did feel like people's energy had moved toward, oh, let's honor those people and not let's go do what we were doing. And they felt like, well, one particular person messaged me and said that that was an exhibit and said that, you know, they thanked me for it because they said it gave them some language to kind of rationalize some of their feelings about being plastered on the side of the building, actually, you know, and feeling like we're still here, all right? And then there were also some people that felt, you know, that like it wasn't so useful. So I tend to kind of just focus on people who it did help. I got a lot more people who were saying that it helped them or that it gave them some, you know, a way to quantify their feelings. And to me, that's really important when you're writing. When I'm writing is to kind of feel what people are feeling and then be able to put that into words for them as well as everyone else to understand us. I feel like that's a key component of the way I like to write. So if I have the option, I always tell people, if you're going to pay me to write what I want, I'll always take that. If you pay me to write what you want, I might or might not. But this is something that I definitely got paid to write what I wanted, and I wrote what I wanted.
Yeah, and I think, again, from the micro level, you know, you talk about in the article as far as like what you think is missing in terms of like just like that context, yeah, like why people are out there. But then just, again, from I don't know, maybe I'm just in that space where it's like I kind of like messy stuff now for a reason. You know, even when it's not like this, I don't feel like this is that messy, but Portland is Portland where
we're so afraid of every conversation, right? Mm-hmm. And it's a thing that happens in liberal spaces. And by liberal, I mean liberal. you know, like people become very obsessed with optics and manners, which are good things, both or things that you should pay attention to. I don't have an issue with people paying attention to those things, but they shouldn't become more important than what it is that you're trying to communicate or what it is you're trying to do. If I have to be so polite that I can't tell you what I need, I'm failing all of us, mm-hmm, right? I'm wasting our time, right? So I think it's important to be able to, you know, we always say speak truth to power, like speak truth to power. Don't be afraid that someone's going to be mad at what you say, because someone's always going to be mad at what you say. You know, if you say defund the police, you know, we should look at the police's processes and perhaps scale back some money, or you say anything, they're still going to say no, and they're still going to find a way to be mad at you, right? So if I'm saying, hey, this exhibit, I feel like it's really good. I do have some questions about the intent based on the inclusion of certain items. They call into question the intent of the entire thing. And then people say, oh, you're just being a jerk. You're just not listening to me, right? You're choosing not to listen actively, and you're trying to make it an issue, which in turn leads to more press and attention. Mm-hmm. So it's a strange beast, but that's just the world that we live in. You have to kind of hype things up and get your, what do you call it, the Charlemagne effect, mm-hmm, where you can, even if it's not really a thing. And I don't think this is a really big thing. Some people are actually upset about it though. So, I mean, that's a real thing. But again, that's the result of art. I consider my writing art. So mm-hmm, if someone feels a way about what I wrote, maybe I did them a favor. Maybe mm-hmm, they got to taste some.
Just lastly, I feel like some of the apprehension may have come from this, well, I'll just call it like a scarcity mindset, mm-hmm, of, you know, this worry anytime there's, you know, you have a big platform. So mm-hmm, if you're critiquing, you know, art, this exhibit mm-hmm, in the Portland Art Museum showcasing photographers of color, that, you know, okay, well, then they're just going to, you know, do the white people thing and be like, well, we tried. And I think it's safe to say that we're beyond that at this point. But yeah. I remember even like when I was, you know, lurking through, because like I said, I enjoy some of the mess. So seeing some of the reactions, just like, popcorn, 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 you know. But I remember someone did type in just like, I think the response was just like more public art or something, just like very simple like that. And it was like, oh yeah, that's the other part that's in this. Or it's like that fear of that this may be it. And it's like,
I didn't get that from that response, but I see how you did. And that's cool. No, I totally, I mean, I can see how somebody would be like, oh no, don't make Massa mad. No, they're not gonna put an art in the museum no more. but in reality, I feel like I pose it as a challenge. You know, you did this, this was a great job. What if we did more? Mm-hmm. What if we went one level deeper in the onion and said, what if we take away one more layer of white perspective from this? You know, the curator is a white person that reports to a white person. So again, we talked about this before in other venues. You know, there's always the layers of whiteness you have to get through to get your art out. So that's okay. The white people have the privilege to just host and do these things, part of the design itself. But also, let's, again, what does it look like to change those barriers? And what does that mean to do that? Why is there no black-led museum? Are there black executives on the staff? Why are there any black curators here? I don't know. Maybe there are. They weren't on this though. So let's talk about it, right? How can we get black art directly out through a black eyes into the media. It's not people. It's like sometimes I think there's a lack of trust of black people to do things, but like people like Jordan Peele in the art spaces are really tearing that apart and showing like, hey, I don't need you. Tyler Perry was kind of a joke, you know, but also very successful, but kind of a joke. Mm-hmm. And Oprah Winfrey is like, you know, Oprah. But then like you see like someone like Jordan Peele, it's like, I'm just being black, bro. I'm hiring the same black actors over and over again. I'm getting this done, bro. Like, we're doing this. And it's like, if you give black people agency, we can do some pretty amazing things. I think this was pretty amazing, but I would have to challenge and ask, you know, maybe not the Portland Art Museum, perhaps the next benefactor says, you know, hey, how can I do this in a way that penetrates even more into the black society, penetrates even more into the hearts of making people think about why people were out there and what it means to have a protest that lasts over 100 days and why it is that all the photos are from the first 60. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not a knock, but it's something to think about, right? Something to think about.
Absolutely. Well, yeah. Matt Smith, thank you again for taking the time this afternoon.
Thank you guys for having me. Appreciate you guys.
This has been the Bruce Poinsett Show. Make sure to catch us every second and fourth Wednesday at 7 p.m. on the Numbers FM, as well as on youtube.com/Bruce Poinsett. And for exclusive clips, go to patreon.com/Bruce Poinsett and become a member. In the meantime, hey, black people, trust me, it won't hurt. See you next week.